Coming up on the Shelley Irwin Show podcast today, we talk about how important getting a good night's sleep is for your physical and mental health. We talk about the book Swiftynomics, how women mastermind and redefine our economy. We talk to the author of the book How to Know Yourself, the art and science of discovering who you really are. Also, the author of How to Be Less Miserable, and the American Diabetes Association updates its standards of care annually, and we look at those changes.
How'd you sleep last night? It's topic of our conversation. Dr. Kelly Gill on the line, neurologist, sleep specialist, Northwestern Medicine. She calls her home. Let's talk about why nearly 30 million Americans live with sleep apnea. Good morning to you, Dr. Gill.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing fine. Hearing that more and more how important sleep is to us. Let's get into the conversation. What is sleep apnea?
So apnea basically means that the airway or throat is collapsing during sleep.
Which sounds kind of scary. Who's at risk?
A little will happen to everyone when we sleep. So the reason is it's a bit of the flaw of the human anatomy. From the nose down, our throat has no bones keeping that airway open. So it's very collapsible. So when we're sleeping, that brain control of our airway is changing for everyone the second we sleep.
How important is a good night's sleep?
Very important for our entire hormone system, heart health, brain health, for everybody.
We are. So what would be a sign and symptom that sleep apnea is happening, and when do I ask for a sleep study?
It can be difficult to know. If you start to notice a change, meaning you're starting to awaken more, feeling more sleepy during the day, having difficulty with memory or concentration, if other people are starting to notice that you're snoring loud, if they think you're not breathing well, sometimes if you're starting even having other symptoms like a lot of acid reflux, your blood pressure starts to become out of control.
And then what does happen during a sleep study?
Well, there are two types of sleep studies. One is what we would consider in the lab or an in-lab polysomnogram, where you go to a sleep laboratory. And essentially, you're wired up from head to toe. We look at your breathing, oxygen, brain waves, muscle activity. It's more in-depth. And they would say, is there a breathing issue or any other type of disorder? They may do part of the night without treatment, part with treatment. The other are home sleep studies, where some equipment might be given to you, and you utilize that equipment at home, and then a report is given to you through the data analyzed from the sleep laboratory.
And then what does the specialist, including yourself, do with results?
Typically, then we would review it with the patient to decide what course of action should we do. So sometimes we'll say, wow, it's normal, nothing more to do. There's something here. It's mild, moderate, or severe. And then decide based on your symptoms and medical comorbidity, what should we do? Occasionally, we might say, especially with a home study, ooh, we didn't get a good result. Let's go to the in-lab and take a look. Or we might say, ooh, this breathing is very severe or complicated. Let's go to the sleep laboratory, do another sleep study, possibly with a machine for breathing, to find out how to make your breathing normal.
Thank you for that, Dr. Kelly Gill, board-certified neurologist, sleep medicine specialist with over two decades of clinical, academic, and research experience, a medical director of the Sleep Center at Northwestern Medical Medicine Central DuPage Hospital. Mouthful, but important with credibility. Moving on to handsome treatment, and are symptoms different and or treatment for women?
Not necessarily. I would say in my own personal practice, everything has to be customized to the individual, male or female. So depending on size, for example, if you might vary the air pressure or the, if you're on a machine, and or the mask style, depending on somebody's size or anatomy of the face.
Is there a way to prevent sleep apnea or sleeping disturbance?
So in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. So it's a little bit of a myth, and often I have to tell people it's not your fault, because genetics is definitely a large factor. Anatomy can be a large factor in the sense of people who have narrow airways. Age can be a factor. So as we age, our airways will become more collapsible. So again, a lot of times it's nothing that somebody did. But the things we can do is to keep a healthy weight can be helpful. That weight can be a factor.
And I trust you'll tell me
to... Particularly in upper airway, like neck.
Ah, yes. And I trust you'll tell me to stay away from my phone before I go to sleep.
Absolutely. So, and that's a whole separate subject. So occasionally people will treat their breathing and say to me, it's not working because I'm still not sleeping. And that's not the case. So unfortunately, some people will have separate issues. Sleep can be very complex. Breathing can be one factor. Insomnia is a whole different ball of wax. It's what we would consider hyper arousal of your brain. It's too turned on. And in today's day and age, there's all this technology that really makes it more difficult. All this electronics and technology is very alerting. And it's absolutely true. Having that phone right before bed is extremely alerting. Our brains are not built for that.
Thank you. What do you leave us with?
Two things. Most important part of getting a good sleep is keeping a consistent schedule. So as much as we can, try to keep a consistent schedule, weekdays and weekends, as much as possible. And then two is easier said than done, but relaxation. This is a stressful time and world, but as much as we're able to do things like deep breathing, warm shower or bath before bed, just general relaxation, very important for everyone's health, mind, and body.
Great. What's a good resource for us? How do we find out more information?
The National Institute of Health is always helpful. Mayo Clinic has a good website and resources.
Please keep up the good work. Thanks for choosing this niche of study. And carry on. Neurologist, sleep specialist, Northwestern Medicine, Dr. Kelly Gill. Take care.
Take care. Thank you.
Well, three times out of four, I bet you say yes. Are you a Taylor Swift fan? Her highly anticipated six-episode Eras Tour did debut on December 12th. The world, of course, watching how one artist commands massive cultural and economic influence. But let's get into, of course, her future and, well, the work by my next guest, Misty L. Haganis, on the line. Swiftynomics, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, how women mastermind and redefine our economy. So this interview is not just about Taylor. Good morning to you, Misty.
Good morning.
Thank you for you and, of course, the work that you do, co-director of the Kansas Population Center, associate professor of economics and public affairs at the University of Kansas, and much more certainly on your list. How did you come up with the topic of, well, Taylor and writing a book for women and economy?
Yeah, Shelley, thanks for having me. This is great. So I am an economist by training. I'm a professor at KU in the School of Public Affairs and Administration. And my area of expertise is women and the economy. And coming out of the pandemic, I'd wanted to write a book about women and you know, while most of us were sitting in our pajamas on the couch, you know, possibly day drinking during the pandemic, Taylor was out being super productive, and she created these two albums, Folklore and Evermore. And so I just started paying more attention to her and just started looking at the way that she proceeds in her career, and just was in awe. And I felt like she's got something that the rest of us could potentially learn from in terms of how to balance our professional life.
So hold your book in my hand. Of course, the Charmed Bracelet forefront, How Women Mastermind and Redefine Our Economy is your tagline. Is Swiftynomics, a word in the dictionary? And how would you define this before we get into details?
Yeah, so as far as I know, it's not a word in the dictionary. It's something that I made up.
Yeah.
but it's really, and notice that it's Swiftynomics in honor of all of Taylor Swift's fans. So, you know, that is also representative of the fact that the book isn't just about Taylor. You know, Taylor has been so economically successful and professionally successful because of her fans, and she is the first one to say it. And so, you know, I think it's really important for us to acknowledge the successes and advances that women have made in society today as economic agents. And it's not only Taylor. You know, she has a lot of fans who have lots of economic agency, who are able to fork out money to go and see her at the Eras Tour, who are able to, you know, sell out Michael's craft stores, beads to make friendship bracelets as part of that community. So it's just a celebration of all of that.
And of course, you don't have to be an economist to dive into your work, because it is for anyone interested in pop culture, gender equity, or economics. And yet, you do offer advice for women to thrive in an economy that was not built for them. Expand on this.
Yeah, so I think if we look back in time, kind of traditionally, what were, you know, these kind of basic or core roles of women and basic and core roles of men, you know, what we'll discover is that really the world inside of our homes is the world that is somewhat dominated by women. And traditionally, the world outside of our homes was a world dominated by men. And so that means that the labor market that women go out and work in, the ways that we exist outside of our home, all of us have to interact with the system that was built for folks with lots of care privilege, folks who, you know, had somebody making their dinners and, you know, washing their clothes. And so, you know, it creates a challenge. And so part of what I'm trying to do in this book is really identify that in an overt way for women, and then think about tools. And so some of the tools that Taylor uses is, you know, she's a queen of masterminding, queen of reinvention, mm-hmm. and she's very, very authentic. And so those are all tools that any of us can use to help us get advance and succeed in the world outside of our homes.
Misty Hagenis with us. Her book is out, Swiftynomics, How Women Mastermind and Redefine Our Economy. Talk to me about pop culture storytelling. How would you define this?
Yeah, so, I mean, in this effort to really want to tell the stories of women better, especially as economic agents in the field of economics, I think it's really important that we try to meet people where they're at. And so economics is historically a very gendered profession. It's dominated by men. And so lots of times women don't see themselves as, potentially understanding economics or wanting to study it. And one of my goals with this book in incorporating pop culture and using pop culture as a narrative to describe economics and economic theory is to hopefully make a space and create a space where women see themselves as economic agents, where young women see a potential for studying economics and for getting into some of these more male-dominated fields.
How did you get interested in this field, Misty?
So I didn't start in economics. My undergraduate degree is in Spanish and family social science, and then I also have a master's in social work. So I came into economics late in the game. I did my PhD in applied economics, and I got into this field because I was really interested in leading my own research, and I wanted in public policy, and I wanted to use tools that would allow me to take large amounts of data and analyze it and be able to come up with potential policy solutions that would be informative. And economics has a really rich set of tools and an expansive toolkit for doing causal analysis. And so that's how I kind of, backwards stumbled into economics, but I'm very passionate about the discipline. I love it. Economics at the end of the day isn't just about Wall Street and finance. It's about all of us having limited resources around us, having, budgets that are constrained by our income and having to make decisions about how we're going to use the resources that we have around us to live our best life. That's what economics is. And I'm in love with it. And I hope that this book helps others fall in love with it, too.
Yes, passion, evidence, good work. Renowned economist Dr. Misty L. Haganis. Swiftynomics, how women mastermind and redefine our economy. How do we find out more information?
Oh, you can, there's a website, swiftynomics.com. You can go to my website, mistyhaganis.com. It's online right now at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookstore.org. So you can find it anywhere. You can pre-order it now and have it arrive at your door on January 27th.
There we are. Thanks, Misty. Keep up your good work and keep sharing this with your students. And thanks for talking.
Thank you.
Well, how well do you know yourself? My next guest comes to the rescue if you're pondering the question, how to know yourself, the art and science of discovering who you really are. We'll ask all the pertinent questions to you, author Eric Oliver. Good morning, Eric.
Hi, good morning.
Appreciate you, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, across the pond, as they say, with your work, your research, as thorough as well. So I look forward to this conversation. Why a book of knowing ourself, Erica?
Well, the ancient Greeks told us that we're supposed to know ourselves, that this is the pathway to a meaningful, happy, and fulfilled life. The problem is that most people haven't really described what this self is that we're supposed to know, or in modern parlance, we're supposed to help. And so I've been teaching a class for about 20 years on this at the University of Chicago, and decided that now would be a pretty good time to try to write what I've learned in 20 years of my own self-exploration, reading into philosophy, psychology, and teaching students. And the real big challenge, I think, at the heart of this is this question that's plagued me for a long time, which is, why don't I live as well as my cat? My cat, I look at, and she seems perfectly content in herself and very happy to, lie about all day. And I seem to be plagued with a lot of intrusive thoughts and, uncomfortable emotions and, just a general existential unease. And so in a lot of ways, what this book is trying to get at, and I don't think I'm alone, by the way. Most people I know, I think, probably share that. And so the book, in a way, is trying to figure out, in some ways, the answer to that even probably deeper question.
Yes. Well, a lens that reframes everything from emotion, identity, to anxiety, purpose, and happiness that you guide us through. So let me dig in a little bit here. From your research, why do our brains, as you mentioned, create a constant background noise of perhaps anxiety, and most of us won't even notice it?
Yeah, I think there's two reasons for it. On the one hand, you got to figure out what yourself is doing. So yourself are basically all the physical and psychological processes that are helping you as a living energy system negotiate with reality. And the way that we have evolved is we have this animal lineage, and our animal ancestors evolved sense organs and brains as a way of processing information from our environment. And what our animal brain is at its core is a prediction machine. So it's looking to make predictions about what it thinks is going to be happening next. And the challenge for us is that we live in a much more complicated and difficult and challenging environment than our ancestors did. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that we, unlike any other animal, are linguistic. We have language, and we've created cultures and institutions and morals and concepts. And in a lot of ways, what these do is confuse our animal brains. And so our animal brains end up spending a lot of time generating anxiety or resentments or unnecessary sadness or regrets about things that really aren't necessarily germane to the moment at hand. We spend a lot of our times living in the past or a lot of times fretting about the future. And the present moment, which, you know, my cat fully inhabits happily, is often elusive to us. And a lot of this stems back to this interaction between, on the one hand, this human culture that we've created and our animal brains, which are these kind of prediction machines.
Again, getting into the topic of knowing thyself with, of course, a book, How to Know Yourself, Eric Oliver with us. Eric, we cling to thoughts, stories, and identities, what, that make us miserable?
Well, unfortunately, they do. To do with how our thoughts get organized. And to understand it, you can go into neuroscience. And what neuroscientists basically say is when we're thinking, what we're doing is just connecting different brain regions. It's all this through the synaptic connection. And these synapses are like highways in our minds. And they develop as we're young. We develop these pathways to help us process information. And the challenge for us is that when we're young, we develop these pathways because they're what's most appropriate for how we're brought up. But the challenge for us is that we get used to certain ways of thinking because at a certain point in time, that might have been useful for us or helpful for us, but they're no longer applicable anymore. And so I like to describe this as survival strategies. As children, we learn certain kind of emotional survival strategies to help us navigate our parents and the world. And, you know, some of us are able to outgrow it, but there's a lot of those that are just so deeply baked into our brains that we just take them for granted. They seem normal. And, you know, a good example of this is somebody, for example, who might have had an abusive childhood and then come to conflate abuse with love. And so even though they're no longer a child, they may seek out partners, for example, who continue to abuse them because that's what they think love really is. And I, you know, that's kind of the, you know, in some ways the most disturbing example of how we sort of end up taking our mental habits for granted or thinking them as real when in fact what they are just mental habits. And so a lot of the thoughts that preoccupy us really are just expressions of these mental habits. And so the key to really knowing yourself is being able to recognize that, oh, these thoughts aren't as real as I think them to be or assume to be. They're really more of a mental habit. And to begin to ask yourself, okay, is this thought really helping anything? And much of the time, at least for me, the answer is no. So it's, you know, the question is then learning how to negotiate with your own thoughts and let go of those ones that are not helping you live better.
So letting go, not striving harder, is, as I'm taking from your work, often the key to psychological freedom?
Yes, and I think there's this, if you look in both the philosophical and psychological and even like Eastern contemplative traditions, there's this kind of dualism that allows us to sort of achieve a kind of better way of living or transcendence. And on the one hand, we need to have a vocabulary to help us recognize our problems. If we can't see what's going on, it's going to be very hard to then, you know, reconcile or negotiate with them. But once we see them, then we have to take even the more difficult step of letting go of them. It's not like, so if you're having bad thoughts, it's not about suppressing your thoughts or trying to eliminate your thoughts. That's going to be impossible. But what you can do is learn to renegotiate your contract with your own thinking process. But it's an odd two-step process because at first you've got to see what's going on. I mean, we all know those people, for example, who stay with that miserable boyfriend or sort of deny that they have a drinking problem. You know, it's so much easier for us to see other people's problems, and it's really, really difficult to see our own. And a lot of it has to do with what I was saying earlier about our own mental habits. But once we are able to expand our vocabulary of our own lived experience, we can begin to recognize, okay, where are the imbalances in our self-processes going on? And then once we're able to see those imbalances, recognize them, then we can sort of say, oh, okay, this is where I can let go. So like what I was describing earlier about saying, oh, is this thought helping anything? And if you say the answer is no, then it's a lot easier to stop dwelling on all of those kind of negative cycles of thinking and feeling that are keeping you caught in an unproductive state.
And tell me a little bit more about the class. I think you taught or still teach the intelligible self students actually routinely describe as life-changing.
Oh, hello?
Yes. Did students take this class called The Intelligible Self? Were they routinely described as life-changing?
Yes. And it's funny because when I first started teaching this class, I didn't realize this was a class on the self. I just had all these interests in things like neuroscience and philosophy and Buddhism. And I put the class together and my wife jokingly said, oh, you should just call the class Stuff I'm Interested In. And then it was only after I was teaching that I was realizing, oh, this is really a class on the self. So I named it The Intelligible Self. And students seem to get a lot out of it. And I think what I was trying to help them do, and this is really what I think of both the purpose of the class and what I'm hoping to do with this book, is help students expand the vocabulary of their own lived experience, giving them some tools to kind of recognize, okay, what's behind this whole feeling of being me? What's limiting my consciousness? How can I grow and live to be a better person? And so a lot of what I do in my class, and I describe a lot of this in the book, is giving them kind of real life exercises to do. So for example, one of my favorite things to do with the students is we talk about like what makes a happy and fulfilling life. And I say, well, you know, it's important to differentiate between pleasure and satisfaction. So we oftentimes equate the happy life with a life filled with pleasure, but our pleasures tend to be short-lived. And so I asked them to go out and I said, this weekend, go do something that gives you pleasure and go do something that makes you feel satisfied and see what the difference is. And then we put all these things together. And, you know, we tend to think that the pleasures tend to be very self-oriented and isolated and short-lived, where our satisfactions tend to be about things that we accomplish and typically things that we accomplish with other people or when we're helping other people. And so a lot of what I try to do in my class is instill these types of lessons in my students. And I'm hoping in the book I can share these with a broader audience as well.
Very nice. What do you leave us with, Eric?
Well, I leave us with is, remember, you are not a noun, you are a verb. And what that means is, you know, at your core, you're a process. And the good news about that is, you are not broken. You are not stuck. You are, a being of continual change, and you can always improve and change yourself. And in fact, this is the key to living well, is figuring out how you can continually try to optimize this, your own experience of being.
Very nice. Eric Oliver, how do we find out more about your work, How to Know Yourself?
Sure. You can find the book starting January 6th on any major website, or you could ask your local bookstore. If you want more information, you can go to jericoliver.com, which is my website, which will have links to where you can find out more about my lecture and where you can find the book.
Cool. Thanks for the conversation, the insight, and getting to know ourselves a little bit better. Take care, Eric Oliver.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Our next conversation, well, required reading, how to be less miserable and the negative mind loops and find joy. Let's get to this conversation. Libby Ma, executive editor of Psychology Today and author of this insightful and endearing new self-help book. Good morning to you, Libby.
Good morning.
That's L-Y-B-A. That's something you probably have to share with everyone who introduces you, makes you unique. I'm glad that you're here. And well, good work with as a longtime executive editor of Psychology Today.
Thank you.
And author, How to Be Less Miserable. Why the need for this title, Libby?
You're not going to find happiness on the cover. I'm sorry.
There you go.
Yep, there you go. You will not find it.
Well, let's take that apart. You do present an accessible guide, practical, science-backed advice from around the world. What, for anyone looking to overcome stress, anxiety, navigate loneliness, and more, you've took on a challenge.
I did. But I feel strongly about it. Yeah.
And why is that? Obviously, it's a no-brainer with you. Psychology Today, you know your psychology. Tell me a little bit about this.
Well, I've seen research coming through for decades, I hate to say. And it's always very interesting. You find out that we can do a lot to change our mood level. And things are bad right now, and people are miserable. And the idea of trying to be happy all the time is not helpful. I don't find it totally realistic to go out and pursue happiness.
And yet we can be less miserable. So tell me a little bit more about current research on the human brain's tendency. Do we have this tendency toward negative thinking, and why do we do it?
Well, the brain evolved that way. So ancient man had to look around for danger all the time. The negative was more important than the positive. And we have carried this into the modern living. We look around and see a nice person walking down the street. That's nice. Great. It makes me happy to see that. You see a dodgy person and you really register what's going on. You have to be careful. You have to be alert of what's happening. So that is why the news is always bad news, bad news, bad news. They give you one clip about a dog at the very end. And that's done for a reason.
Called the kicker. You'll get positive news here, my friend, that's for sure. Tell me what readers will learn according to my notes. Will you teach us how to deal with our emotions?
Well, first of all, we have to call them out. Because the brain will tell you anything it wants to tell you. And it's not reality. Your thoughts are not real. Often we're stuck in distorted thinking. And when there are grievances and insults, it sticks with us. You remember when that person said that thing to you and that was so rude. And it rolls in your head over and over and over and over. Well, that is the brain doing what it wants to do. We have a negativity bias. And the negative thoughts we have fill our mind. We do all sorts of strange things, jump to conclusions. My date hated me, fortune tell. Why would they call me back? I'm a loser. Mind read, I know you're thinking about me and it's bad, all or nothing. I will not be happy until the end of time. Catastrophize, bad things always happen to me. So it just goes, churns. But if we are aware that it's happening, we can do something about it. Being aware is half the battle.
Thank you. Would there be perils of social media? Let's just go here.
Yeah. we look at social media and we everybody else has a wonderful life. Why is mine so horrible? And it goes on. It makes you feel worse and worse and worse. And that's just the way it is. We stick to this idea of we are terrible and everybody else is happy and wonderful. That's just the way it is. We can't help but compare ourselves.
The book is How to Be Less Miserable in the Negative Mind Loops and Find Joy, talking with author Libby Ma. Libby, you do talk a bit about being kind and true to yourself, somewhat in repeat, but not that number one comes first, but be kind to ourselves.
Yes, we have a hard time doing that. we have a hard time being kind and giving and treating ourselves like we would a friend. we talk to ourselves in a way we would never talk to a friend. Mm-hmm. And Kristen Neff has done great research on this. And if we were more compassionate to ourselves and showed ourselves grace, we can get through a lot of bad things that we perceive in life. We're perceiving it.
More on perhaps a couple of key takeaways before we get you back to work. You do ask us to embrace the mystery of life. This can help us out. As you mentioned in the beginning, nothing's going to change overnight. And, you know, there is some sadness in the world.
Oh, yes. We do not like to sit with our negative emotions, but we should, because the negative emotions are part of how we feel, and we can't negate it. We just have to feel them. That's a very Asian Buddhist way of thinking about it, but we have to accept how we're feeling, sad, angry, anxious. All of those emotions in moderate doses are fine. If you want to go overboard, then that would not be good. But you have to feel them and not throw them out. It makes life richer and fuller, and you will become more psychologically whole.
Where do I start besides reading chapter one of How to Be Less Miserable? Come in with a good mindset?
Sure, yeah. Be open. That's one thing. Being open to things. We are very closed when we look at stuff. Oh, I'm not going to go there. That's bad. That person looks terrible or whatever. I don't know. We do a lot of things in our heads and we want to shut ourselves down a bit. But being open to opportunity, being open to other people and seeing what's out there can help.
How do we find out more about your work, Libby?
Oh, well, you can find the book on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Will be out in October. On October 14, and I'm on the Psychology Today website. Actually, I review a lot of submissions from academics and clinicians, so you might see my name there somewhere.
There. Multitasking, thank you for leading us into this journey of how to be less miserable in the negative mind loops and find joy is your latest work. Thank you, Libby Ma.
Thank you.
American Diabetes Association has updated a standard of care, their standards of care for 2026. Just moving into a new year, let's talk new goals and, well, maybe new standards. Only get the best. Glad that you are here. ADA's Chief Scientific and Medical Officer, Dr. Rita Kalyani. Good morning to you, Dr. Rita.
Good morning.
Appreciate you. Why your interest in diabetes?
Thanks for covering this topic. I've had a long involvement with the American Diabetes Association. I've had many family members affected by diabetes, and so really am dedicated to the mission of the organization, and so thrilled to be talking with you today.
Great. Let's get into the conversation. Standards of care important in diabetes, gold standard in evidence-based guidelines for diagnosing and managing diabetes and pre-diabetes. Would you expand on that?
As you mentioned, the American Diabetes Association standards of care in diabetes are often considered the gold standard, a reference in the evidence-based care of people with diabetes. We develop it every year at the ADA together with our team of experts on the Professional Practice Committee. And the standards of care are based on the latest scientific research and clinical trials, including strategies for diagnosis and treating diabetes in both youth and adults. The standards of care, which are a series of recommendations and best practices for diabetes, at least annually, so that people with diabetes can get the latest, most effective evidence-based treatment.
Why are they important?
We know that diabetes affects so many people in the United States and around the world. Nearly one in two Americans has diabetes or prediabetes. That's 136 million Americans living with diabetes or prediabetes currently as we speak. For healthcare professionals, the standards of care provide comprehensive medical guidance for people living with diabetes and their management. And then for people living or caring for someone with diabetes, the standards of care can help you feel confident and informed about managing your diabetes at home. It includes important information on screening, diabetes prevention, mental and physical health, medication, and much more, all aspects of caring for the whole person with diabetes.
What would be then, I guess, getting right to the source new in this year's recommendations?
There were dozens of updates based on the latest evidence to this year's recommendations. I'll highlight just a few. The rest can be found at diabetes.org. The first is recommendations regarding diabetes technology. We know that the number of technological devices available for the management of diabetes continues to increase. And we have added recommendations regarding use of continuous glucose monitors for when a person is diagnosed with diabetes and at any time after, for anyone who could improve their diabetes management with this use. There are also other recommendations on nutrition, guidance of eating patterns with evidence for prevention of type 2 diabetes, medications taken by mouth or injected, such as insulin. And new this year are recommendations to harness the additional benefit of medications beyond glucose lowering, such as reducing risk of heart disease, kidney disease, and also liver health, which we know is closely tied to type 2 diabetes in conversations with your healthcare provider. And also new this year is expanded guidance on screening and monitoring people at risk for type 1 diabetes.
This is obviously talking diabetes on behalf of the American Diabetes Association Chief Scientific and Medical Officer, Dr. Rita Kalyani, with us. Talk to me about what you're hoping we do take away from the ADA's recommendations.
The American Diabetes Association Standards of Care is grounded in science, and we encourage the use of standards of care as a resource for information on preventative screening, not only for diabetes itself, but for prevention of dental conditions, kidney disease, eye health, which can all be affected by diabetes, how to use diabetes technology so that it can be of greatest benefit in the management, medication, and lifestyle recommendations as well, depending on where you are in your diabetes journey. And then, importantly, prevention of complications. What can an individual do today to prevent getting complications from diabetes in the long run? Overall, we hope people will use it as a tool to work closely with their health professional to get the care and support they need.
Wonderful. Where do we go for more information?
For more information, the standards of care, including information and infographics, can be found on the American Diabetes Association website at diabetes.org. For type 2 diabetes, the ADA also has a patient version of the standards of care. It can also be found on that website. And we also have a free online type 2 diabetes risk calculator at diabetes.org/risk-test if you want to know your own risk for developing diabetes. At the ADA, it's our mission to prevent and cure diabetes and to improve the lives of all people affected by the disease. And we encourage people to join us, keeping the momentum going.
Thanks for your expertise and this conversation. Keep up the good work. Standards of care out for 2026. Thank you.